just quickly, Dr. Hugh Ross, whom I've been announcing for our chapels. Astronomer Hugh Ross has dedicated his professional life to bridging the perceived gap between science and faith. He received his B.S. in physics from the University of British Columbia, M.S., Ph.D. in astronomy from the University of Toronto. He serves on the faculty of Simon Greenleaf University, is on the staff of Sierra Madre Congregational Church. As president of Reasons to Believe, a nonprofit corporation, Dr. Ross speaks to audiences throughout North America. He's spoken at numerous universities, churches, businesses, professional meetings, has been abroad to all kinds of countries. He's written extensively. He is the author of Creation and Time, Creator and the Cosmos. Several other books that will be available in the lobby afterwards today for sale here in Chafer. He's published articles in scientific journals, Christianity Today, Moody Magazine, etc. also. He's host on television series Reasons to Believe on Trinity Broadcasting Network, has recently been guest on Focus on the Family with James Dobson. He and his wife Kathy and their two sons make their home in Southern California. So I want you, and you have a brochure, I think, that has been passed out to you. I hope you have that in hand. If not, pick something up after you are leaving today at the end of chapel. We have four microphones stationed here, and at a certain point, Dr. Ross is going to give you opportunity for some interaction. Let's welcome Dr. Hugh Ross to our platform.
Well, our organization, Reasons to Believe, is a small cadre of research scientists. And as we study the frontiers of scientific endeavor, we're counting between 5 and 10 discoveries per month that add to the weight of proof for the God of the Bible and the reliability of the words of the Bible. And what I'd like to do in just a few minutes is quickly survey for you the discoveries of the past 2 years that are strengthening the case for the God of the Bible. We'll just take a few highlights here. And you can pick up our newsletter at the back there. You can get a free year subscription to that newsletter that's designed to keep you up to date on these latest scientific discoveries that are making Christian evangelism so much easier than just a few months ago. Let me take you back not quite 2 years. This is when they announced the Nobel Prize in Physics. It was given to Hulse and Taylor for their 25 years worth of research on a binary pulsar. You say, what's a binary pulsar? Two neutron stars orbiting about one another. You say, that's great. What's a neutron star? It's a giant star so highly collapsed it's only 6 miles in diameter. The density inside these neutron stars exceeds 5 billion tons per teaspoonful. And so with such huge densities, this represents the very best laboratory site in the universe for testing theories of gravity. To give you an example, the gravitational forces we measure around this binary pulsar are hundreds of thousands of times greater than anything else we measure in the universe. And it was through this study that Hulse and Taylor were able to conclude that the theory of general relativity accurately describes the dynamics of the universe to better than 14 decimal point precision. In other words, today we can claim that general relativity has been proven to better than a trillionth of a percent precision. In the words of Roger Penrose, Britain's famous physicist, he says this makes general relativity one of the best established principles in all of physics. You say, what's the big deal about that? The proof of general relativity has 3 significant theological consequences. The first comes through something incredibly beautiful. In fact, I'd like to start the morning off here with something I think transcends the beauty of anything you've ever witnessed. This is the equation that convinced Albert Einstein that God must exist. This comes out of his theory of general relativity, and if you push through a solution to that equation, it reveals that the universe must be exploding. And as Einstein reasoned, if the universe is exploding, it must have a beginning, therefore a beginner. And to his dying day, he held to the belief that God exists and that God created the universe. But something much more profound happened 2 generations later. 2 British physicists, Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose, were able to develop a much more thorough solution of this equation, and they published it in this paper, The Singularities of Gravitational Collapse in Cosmology. You all got to go out and get this thing. It's fascinating reading. You just can't put it down. Those of you who are fans of tensor calculus will just eat this right up. But it ends with the now famous space-time theorem of general relativity, which states that if the universe contains mass, and if the universe is governed by the equations of general relativity, then not only do we have an ultimate origin for all the matter and energy in the universe, like Einstein discovered, there must be a simultaneous ultimate origin of the space-time dimensions along which that matter and energy are distributed. As Hawking himself boasted, we proved that time has a beginning. We proved that time was created. And we didn't realize what he was saying. But his wife for 22 years, Jane Hawking, was an evangelical Anglican, and Stephen did research with a friend of mine from Caltech, Don Page, who's an evangelical physicist. And both of them had the opportunity to point out, you know, the proof that space and time have a beginning, the proof that space and time are created, is equivalent to proving that Jesus Christ is the creator. You say, how so? Well, look at all the holy books of the religions of the world and the doctrines that they promote. What they have in common is that they claim that God or gods create within the dimension of time. Where Christianity stands apart from these space is it insists that God creates independent of time. Time has a beginning. God was operating through cause and effect before the beginning of time. Now, last December, this was pushed forward to a new level of significance. What happened last December, in fact, some of our volunteer physicists were involved in this research. And actually, I should back up a bit. A problem facing theoretical physics for the past 10 years is that all of our theories of gravity prove that there shouldn't be any quantum mechanics. And all of our theories of quantum mechanics prove that there shouldn't be any gravity. And we have overwhelming experimental proof that both are true. So how do we get out of this problem? Well, what happened was some physicists at the University of California, Santa Barbara, said the only possible solution is if black holes can go to zero mass. Well, that just leads you to another paradox. How can you have zero mass black holes? I mean, by definition, a black hole is a massive body so highly collapsed that the gravity exerted by the mass attracts everything into it, even light itself. How can you have gravity without mass? Well, what Andrew Strominger and Jerry Cleaver, one of our volunteers, picked up on is that it's impossible in four space-time dimensions, but it can work if these black holes are collapsing in six dimensions of space that are independent of length, width, height, and time. Now, as a pure bonus, what flows out of this theory, if you work out these 10 spatial dimensional equations for the creation of the universe, what flows out of the equations is a pure bonus are all the equations of special and general relativity. As Jerry Cleaver explained to me, if we knew nothing about relativity at all, and we came up with this 10-dimensional string theory, it would have given us special and general relativity as a gift. Now, the significance of that is today we can prove special relativity to 21 places of the decimal and general relativity to 14 places of the decimal, which means we have a similar level of confidence that the universe was created with 10 space-time dimensions that later shrunk down to an effect of 4. Actually, to put it more exactly, what's going on here is that God creates the universe with 10 space-time dimensions. These 10 space-time dimensions begin to expand from this infinitely small volume. But at a little less than a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the creation event, six of those dimensions of space stop expanding, and the other four continue to expand. This is the four that we're all comfortable with, length, width, height, and time. Those other six dimensions, by the way, are still there. It's just that they're curled up into circles that are no bigger than a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a centimeter. So effectively, they don't play any significant role in our daily lives. But the bottom line is, it demonstrates to 14 and 21 places of the decimal that the creator of the universe is a being who has the minimum capacity to move and operate in the equivalent of 11 space-time dimensions. Now, I believe God's power far exceeds that. But isn't it wonderful that we live in a day and an age when we can establish scientifically that he has at least that capacity to move and operate in the equivalent of 11 space-time dimensions? Theologically, what it does for us, there's another theorem of mathematics that states that no one can visualize phenomena in dimensions that he or she cannot personally experience. This is why when you look at the other holy books of the religions of the world, you note that they describe God in a four-dimensional context. Every doctrine that they have about God or their gods is something that can be comprehended, visualized within four space-time dimensions. Christianity stands apart from that. Only Christianity describes God as a triune being, simultaneously singular and plural. Only Christianity speaks about human free will simultaneously operating with divine predestination. The doctrine of eternal security is present only in the Christian faith. The other faiths reject that. Why? Because they're mathematical absurdities if God is limited to four space-time dimensions. I don't know about you, but I get gentlemen coming up to my home door in dark suits with these black attaché cases, and when they find out that I'm a Christian, they say, well, don't you realize, sir, that Christianity presents us with mathematical impossibilities? And I say, you gentlemen are absolutely right. The Trinity is a mathematical impossibility in four space-time dimensions. But do you gentlemen have 4 minutes for me to share with you? The latest scientific evidence is that God is not limited to just four space-time dimensions, but has this extra-dimensional capacity. And if they stay for 5 more minutes, I can show them a possible solution to the triune God, free will and predestination, eternal security, in a context of 8 or more space-time dimensions. Now, this is the subject of my just-released book, Beyond the Cosmos, outlining in layman's language exactly how we've been able to prove scientifically that God has this capacity, and then begin to show you how we can resolve these paradoxical doctrines in the Bible. But the end of the book deals with a point. This is unique to the Christian faith. We don't see it in the other religions. And this is a piece of evidence that we can present to everyone that the words of the Bible come from a transcendent being, whereas the words of the other holy books are mere human inventions. And also, I've discovered that even with Christians, sometimes it's helpful to show them possible solutions for these paradoxical doctrines, because it can build their faith, that it can increase their confidence that God really does have these powers and capacities and can really operate personally in our lives. I found, for example, with my 2 sons, both of them at the age of 3 asked me the question, how can God listen to all of our prayers? What if everybody in the world prays at once? And so I had an opportunity to explain to them that if God has the capacity to operate in the equivalent of 2 dimensions of time, which is something that's been known for the past 15 years now, then that means that here we are in a timeline, 6 billion people pray to God all at once. So in 1 microsecond, God's got 6 billion prayers pouring in his direction. But all he would have to do would be to drop the equivalent of a perpendicular timeline to our timeline. So our timeline's going this way, his is going this way, and he can take infinite time to deal with the 6 billion prayers that are being poured up in that single microsecond. And what I've discovered is that even at 3 years of age, children can comprehend that God is paying attention to them at every moment in their lives, and it builds their confidence in God hearing their prayers and answering their prayers. Now, for those of you that are financially challenged, we have a back issue of Facts and Faith, a 5-page description of this discovery and some of its theological implications. And since this is a seminary, what we really do is we close off the book saying, this is what science has discovered, but there's a great need for theologians and philosophers to jump into this and begin to start what has simply been a beginning. You know, what is this dimensional proof mean in terms of us being able to communicate some of the problems and paradoxes of the Christian faith and the evangelistic means to the community at large? I think we're just simply beginning on a new way of doing evangelism. But when I speak on this on secular university campuses, I mean, what I've given to you here in a few minutes could be described, at least from the perspective of a physicist, as the most mathematical, rigorous proof for the God of the Bible. But I've discovered that even technically trained audiences appreciate more tangible proofs for the God of the Bible. And let me just hit that quickly. 15 years ago, I couldn't give this message. Today, we can, because for the first time in history, the universe has been measured by astronomers. In fact, today we can measure 29 different characteristics of the universe. What we astronomers have discovered is that every single one of those characteristics must be exquisitely fine-tuned in order for any kind of conceivable life to exist. Now, I haven't got the time to take you through all of this. This is dealt with in my book, The Creator and the Cosmos. But let me just give you one. In order for planets, stars, and galaxies to form, gravity must be the dominant force in the universe. Gravity, after all, is what takes two massive objects and attracts them under its influence. And in order to get galaxies, stars, and planets forming, it's necessary that these atoms coalesce under that influence and form these larger bodies. The problem is that stars cannot shine in a stable fashion unless the force of electromagnetism is 10,000 trillion, trillion, trillion times stronger than the force of gravity. So it seems to give you a dilemma. You can't have stars unless electromagnetism is 10,000 trillion, trillion, trillion times stronger than gravity, but stars won't form in the first place unless gravity is the dominant force. The only way out is to make the universe perfectly electrically neutral, so that the number of negatively charged particles in the universe is exactly equal to the number of positively charged particles in the universe, to better than 1 part in 10 to the 37, so that electromagnetism can be canceled off throughout the whole of the cosmos and gravity can dominate. Well, that's 37 zeros after the 1. And I've discovered that non-technically trained audiences have a hard time grappling or visualizing numbers of that size. In my book, I tried comparing it to the national debt, but even the national debt doesn't come close to such a large number. So I'll give you a different analogy. Let's compare the design of the universe, just in this one characteristic, to the very best level of human design achievement that we can point to. The one that we can point to is a machine, not yet built, but thanks to the generosity of your tax dollars, it's promised to be ready by the year 2000. This is a gravity wave detector being built by Caltech and MIT physicists. It is so well engineered that it will have the capacity to make measurements to 1 part in 10 to the 23. But that 1 part in 10 to the 23 ranks as 100 trillion times inferior to this 1 part in 10 to the 37. This immediately allows us to conclude that God must be not only a transcendent being, but a personal being. I mean, no one's going to stub his toe on this gravity wave detector in the year 2000 and conclude that it's a product of a tornado whipping through the Texas plain with a bunch of dust and scrap metal, moving it 2,000 miles, dropping it in place, and having it in perfect working order to make measurements to 1 part in 10 to 23. That's not going to happen. Rather, what's going to happen, you're going to stand in awe at the wisdom of those Caltech and MIT physicists and at the funding of those Caltech and MIT physicists. But we can use the same argument to develop some more personal characteristics of the Creator. The Creator must be a powerful being. He must be at least 100 trillion times better funded than those Caltech and MIT physicists. He must be at least 100 trillion times more intelligent and at least 100 trillion times more creative. So what we've done here in a few minutes is establish scientifically that the Creator is transcendent, personal, creative, intelligent, and powerful. Now, when this was confronted to Stephen Hawking, his response, and by the way, this isn't my best argument. In my book, The Creator and the Cosmos, I describe other characteristics of the universe where the level of design is a million trillion times better than this 1 part in 10 to the 37. So without exception, physicists and astronomers who've made a study of this field have concluded, whether they're atheists, agnostics, theists, deists, whatever, they've all concluded that what we're presented here is overwhelming evidence for design and therefore for a designer. But Stephen Hawking's rebuttal to all of this is to say, sure, there's a designer, a capital D designer. But he says it can't be the God of the Bible, because in the Bible we see that God is a being that practices economy. You know, and I would agree with Stephen on that. You know, God doesn't waste his miracles. And he says, all we need for life here on planet Earth is one star, one planet, one moon, and maybe a Jupiter and a Saturn. Actually, I'd argue you need all the bodies of the solar system to make it work, but you know, I'll give him his due. The point he's making is this. God wouldn't have wasted his creative effort building 100 billion trillion stars and setting them in place for 16 billion years. That just wouldn't be in line with the economy of God. But what Hawking stumbled over is the fact that the mass density of the universe is one of these 29 characteristics that must be fine-tuned for life to exist. The mass of the universe acts as a catalyst for nuclear fusion. If the mass of the universe is too small, then fusion will operate at such a low level of efficiency that the universe will forever remain 100% hydrogen. But if the mass of the universe is too great, then all the matter in the universe will be quickly converted into elements heavier than iron. Both ways, you wind up with a cosmos devoid of carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, the elements that are essential for any kind of conceivable life chemistry. It only works in a cosmos of 100 billion trillion stars, that's precisely 16 billion years old. This is a narrow window of time in which life is possible. Therefore, it allows me to make an interesting paraphrase of John 3:16, if you will permit. For God so loved the human race that he went to the expense of building 100 billion trillion stars and carefully shaped and crafted them for 16 billion years, so at this brief moment in time, we could all have a nice place to live. Now, an exercise I gave to the parishioners in our church was to ask them to calculate this degree of expenditure. And it's something you can all do. Get the Wall Street Journal and look up the price of helium on the world market at the density of water. The sun is at the density of water. Do the same for hydrogen. And knowing that the sun is 886,000 miles in diameter, you can calculate how many U.S. dollars it would take to build one star like the sun. Then multiply that sum of U.S. dollars by 100 billion trillion and amortize it at 8% interest for 16 billion years. And now you've got a rough idea of the minimum expenditure that the Creator put out so that we could have a nice place to live today. What does it tell us? We're not just looking at a creator that's transcendent, personal, powerful, creative, and intelligent, but one that is caring and loving towards the human species. I submit to you that the establishment scientifically of those personal characteristics for the creator is sufficient to rule out all possibilities but Jesus Christ. I mean, stack up the gods of the religions of the world. Which one matches these conclusions that have come out of the scientific research of the past 2 years? Jesus Christ himself is the only one that remains. We can extend this argument to the solar system. When we look at the solar system, we discover that there are now 50 characteristics that must be fine-tuned for life to possibly exist on our planet. Now, what's remarkable is that when I wrote this second edition to The Creator and the Cosmos, we were describing 42 of these characteristics. It's 12 months out of date. Because of the pace of new discoveries, we're now publishing updates that we're distributing to people who buy the book. Based on this update, the proof that we have today that God created the solar system for the benefit of humanity is 1 trillion times stronger than it was just 12 months ago. Again, as seminary students and professors, where can you go in Christian scholarship and get a factor of a trillion times more evidence for God in just 1 year? Which leads me to my final point. It's not just astrophysics where we can develop these overwhelming proofs for the God of the Bible. When we hit secular university campuses, our tactic now is to come with a team of research scientists from different disciplines of expertise. And what we're trying to do there is reveal to the professors, not so much the students, we're really after the professors, to demonstrate to the professors that no matter what discipline of science you pick, we're going to see through the discoveries of the past 1, 2, 3 years that we have overwhelming evidence for the God of the Bible, which means that in one context at least, maybe we're living in the days of the fulfillment of Revelation 3:8. I place before you an open door that the secularists and the atheists cannot shut. Again, if you'd like a free subscription to our Facts and Faith newsletter, you can get one by calling this 800 number or picking the information up at the back. They've asked me to leave some time for questions. I will take questions on any subject that deals with science, faith, and the Bible. It doesn't have to be about 10-dimensional string theory. Okay, so whatever you'd like to do, we'll take a stab at it. And incidentally, our Reasons to Believe organization has a hotline. You can call us between 5 and 7 p.m. Pacific time with your questions, debate issues, etc. Go ahead.
Yeah, Dr. Ross, I'd just like to say, as a physicist and a fellow creation scientist, I really enjoyed your presentation. But in reading some of your books, I have some big theological questions. And in your book, Creation and Time, on page 67, you state that the process of decay has been in effect since the universe was created. And when we look at the fossils, we can see pain, death, and suffering. And according to your book, all those fossils were laid down before Adam was created. And this basically is saying that there was death before Adam's sin. And Romans makes it clear that it wasn't until Adam sinned that death entered the world. So in dealing with people that are not Christians, many times they say that God is not a God of love because there's pain, death, and suffering in the world. Now, if there's pain, death, and suffering before sin, then that makes God the author of that instead of sin being the author of pain, death, and suffering. So if the original universe or the original world that God created was perfect, as he states in Genesis, it wouldn't make sense for Adam to be there, created perfectly on a pile of bones that reflected death and suffering.
In terms of the problem of evil, this is a major theme of Beyond the Cosmos. And the point I make in the book is that to resolve the problem of evil, you first must resolve the free will predestination paradox, and after that, the eternal security paradox. Then and only then are you in a position to deal in a satisfying way, at least for non-Christians, with the problem of evil, because you're making a good point. If we accept the doctrine of predestination, that makes God the author of evil, what's he up to? Well, my point is that this is only resolvable in a context beyond the four space-time dimensions that people traditionally try to grapple with this problem of evil. So that's kind of a step-by-step approach to dealing with the problem of evil. Back to Romans 5:12, which is the verse you mentioned about Adam being the author of death. The book of Romans, it deals with four different kinds of death. It talks about physical death, spiritual death, death to the law, and death to sin. So it's important in reading Romans chapter 5 to try to determine which of the four deaths the Apostle Paul is speaking about. And actually, the verse itself helps clarify it. It tells us that the death that Adam introduced is death through sin, and that it was visited upon human beings. Notice that the text carefully excludes any mention of plants and animals. It only focuses on the human species. Now see, we're the only species that's capable of dying through sin. We're the only species that God created that's body, soul, and spirit. Other species may be body and soul, some are body only, but we're the only one that is spiritual, the only one that's capable of going through this death through sin. So in that sense, I would say that what the Apostle Paul is speaking about is spiritual death, of which physical death is a consequence. Physical death followed the introduction of spiritual death. Genesis 3 clarifies that for us because God warns Adam, "In the day that you eat of that fruit, you will die." He ate of the fruit, and he instantly experienced spiritual death. His relationship with God was broken. But it was later that God brought physical death as a consequence upon him, namely that physical death really should be looked upon as a blessing, an act of mercy on the part of the Creator to deliver us from the worst consequence of spiritual death. So in that sense, I tend to look upon spiritual or physical death as a blessing much more so than as a curse. in terms of my comment about the laws of physics not changing when Adam sinned, as an astronomer, I can tell you we can look back in time. That's the beauty of astronomy. It never measures the present. It only measures the past. And the reason why so many powerful proofs for a creation are coming out of astronomy is the one science where we can go back in time and witness the works of creation. We can even go back so far in time that we can see when darkness separated from light. That took place 300,000 years creation event.
My question is, though, why was the creation given over to futility? And the Hebrew was, you shall surely die, is basically, dying you shall die. From that point on, they started to experience physical death. In the same way, when a baby is born, as soon as it is born, it begins to die.
Yeah, my point is that the introduction of physical death for humanity does not mean that there was no physical death for plants and animals before.
Then how could it be a perfect created
environment?
Well,
that's your interpretation of what's perfect. I'm saying we need to look at this from God's perspective rather than from man's perspective. From our perspective, it seems uncomfortable. I mean, as a father, I notice that with my children. When I discipline them, they don't like it. As the scripture tells us, discipline, we see the benefit of it after we grow through that discipline. So currently, from our present perspective, it may not seem like the best. But taking God's perspective, we realize that God is using evil and suffering, the second law of thermodynamics, the law of decay, to prepare us for something far better, something extra-dimensional, beyond what we can think and imagine. As Paul says, the rewards of the kingdom of heaven are so great, so wonderful, that none of us can think or imagine what it will really be like. And this is kind of the theme of this book, is that in order to get a grasp on this, we need to get a clear picture of the physics of the new creation.
Thank you very much. Those were good questions. Michael, you want to take the next one here? And let's move very quickly. It's really time to quit here. But
right. Okay, two real quickies. One, you talk about the 16 billion year age for the universe. I gather that means the indicator is different from the one I was accustomed to hearing about.
Can you speak up, Michael?
Is the current indicator for the age of the universe then astronomy? And I was still dealing with the 4.5 billion years from uranium decay. But
yeah, there's a difference between the age of the Earth and the age of the universe.
I see. Okay.
Now, the age of the Earth is now known to 0.1% precision, mm-hmm. 4.59 billion. Yeah. The most accurate date for the age of the universe is 15.5 billion plus or minus 1 billion.
Okay.
But those are all garnered to us through scientific measurements.
Right. I was going to ask how the original element levels were determined. But all my,
how the original element levels were determined?
Yeah.
You can go back in time and check it out. In other words, all you need to do is find galaxies that are, say, 14 billion light years away, witness the first supernova eruptions, and that will give you the original abundances of uranium and thorium.
Ah.
And then we can check the decay rates from 14 billion years up to the present.
Okay, and the second one quickly.
All right.
The various, various views of the nature of the quantum universe, what's your take on that?
I didn't quite catch that last phrase.
Been understanding the, or trying to get a handle on the various interpretations of what reality is according to the quantum phenomena. What's your take on it?
Well, it's a good point. He's asking a question about quantum mechanics, and you know, several theologians have identified quantum mechanics as the most serious challenge to the Christian faith. It's because people don't understand quantum mechanics. And New Age philosophers, for example, have taken advantage of that misunderstanding of quantum mechanics to claim it supports their worldview, when in fact the exact opposite is true. A proper understanding of quantum mechanics elevates God and demotes man, rather than what the New Agers claim, that it elevates man and demotes God. I devoted three chapters in The Creator and the Cosmos to quantum mechanics, particularly dispelling this idea that the universe could be the result of a quantum fluctuation. If it is, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle would tell us it would have to go back into space fluctuations in a time scale briefer than 10 to the minus 122 seconds. And all of us are living proof that the cosmos has been here longer than 10 to the minus 122 seconds. And so quantum mechanics strengthens the Christian faith rather than weakening the Christian faith.
We take just one. I'm going to just be able to take one more quick question, and that then If you gentlemen will slip up here very quickly, you can ask your question there, and then I'm going to have to dismiss.
Okay. As a non-scientist, quick dating question. I've read several popular books that talked about a possibility of the speed of light decaying. What's the current status of that theory, and if so, doesn't that affect a lot of these things like uranium dating?
Yeah, it would, but the claim is entirely bogus. The speed of light is one of those 29 characteristics that must be exquisitely fine-tuned in order for life to exist. Not only must it be fine-tuned, it must be held constant for the entire age of the universe, or life will be impossible. To give you a quick understanding of that, there are many ways, but here's a quick one. E equals mc squared. Now, I found that everybody knows at least that one equation. All right, if you change C, it's going to have a big impact on either E or M. Both ways, it's going to kill you. The fact that atoms survived means that the luminosity of the sun could not have been exponentially higher in the days that he was created, or that the elements of which the universe is composed of couldn't have been radically different. He wouldn't have been able to survive either of those consequences. The other point is that this idea that the speed of light has been decaying is based on a bad analysis of Earth-based measurements of the velocity of light for the past 300 years. In fact, it's based on misquotes. But more than that, these authors failed to recognize that in astronomy, we routinely measure the velocity of light for the entire history of the cosmos. All the way back to 14 billion light years, we can measure this velocity of light in stars and galaxies. It's exactly the same as what we measure today, so we can prove that it's been held rigidly constant. Bottom line is this. Every argument that's been put forward by young Earth creationists to establish that the Earth or the universe is young is bogus, every single one. If you want to challenge me that, call our hotline, and we'll give you the stuff behind it. If you want to take a faster route to that, just ask young universe creationists. Have you ever convinced a scientist, independent of the Bible, that either the Earth is young or the universe is young? Every time, the answer is no. So that tells you right away that it lacks scientific credibility. Then you can go to your seminary professors here and say, well, what about the biblical perspective? And I think you'll get a similar answer.
Dr. Ross, thank you so much for coming today. And let's welcome him. God bless you. Thank you very much.